Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Emma Pei Yin about her debut historical fiction novel, When Sleeping Women Wake. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can gain access to your members-only Discord server. You can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time. And if you join us on the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a book club pick once per quarter. Definitely appreciate everyone who has joined us so far, and hope to see more of you there in the future.
Yeah, so we talked with Emma about her historical fiction novel, When Sleeping Women Wake. It's set in 1941, and the Japanese invade Hong Kong, and it tells the story of three women and their individual paths to resistance. It was a very thrilling read for both Marvin and myself, so I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation with Emma. We are here with Emma Pei Yin, a British-born Hong Kong Chinese writer and editor. She contributes to the Mekong Review, the Hong Kong Review, Being Asian Australian, and more. And her debut novel, When Sleeping Women Wake, is out now in booksellers everywhere. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad that we were able to make time for our listeners. We had scheduled this interview a while back, closer to Emma's book's release date, but because of scheduling, we're here now. So I'm so happy that you're here. Before we dive into your book, I would like to ask you what your favorite tea is, because you grew up in the UK and you grew up in Hong Kong, and those are very tea biased areas. So what's your favorite tea?
I have to say, growing up in the UK, obviously a good PG Tips, a nice cup of PG Tips with digestive biscuits. And then when I moved to Hong Kong, my go-to whenever I went to Yum Cha with my family was oolong cha. And then moving to Australia, coffee is a huge thing, but I'm still very much a tea drinker and I'm all about matcha tea at the moment. So those are the three teas that I always go to.
Yeah, matcha's having its moment right now. I think, like, I don't know if I read this right or wrong, but it's like it got TikTok famous and now there's a shortage.
Yeah, I heard about that as well.
Man.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I went to London last year and I just saw so many signs promoting what matcha was. Like, because people didn't know what it was, apparently. And I'm like, matcha's been around for like centuries now.
Oh,
like,
my God. This yes, it's the weird. Same with goji berries.
Yeah.
So it's having its moment now. And I'm just really curious as to like what the next big drink is going to be. So we'll see. But I love oolong personally. So you have great taste.
Yeah. I've always been partial to a good pu'er.
Pu'er is good. It's good for digestion.
So I hear, yeah.
As we get older, yeah. So we mentioned that you grew up in the UK and also Hong Kong. So I'm curious, what was your diaspora experience like in both countries? Because I'm sure it was different.
I love that question. You know, I was talking to someone the other day about how, you know, when you are Asian growing up in, you know, essentially a white country and then moving to an Asian country, you end up straddling like two cultures, two languages, two traditions. And when I moved to Hong Kong, I was only 14. And, you know, when you're a teenager, everything is like amplified emotionally. And so, you know, looking back now, might have overreacted a little bit with the whole move. But it was really, it was very eye-opening because I think it was at that age, that move essentially made me then question my identity. Exactly kind of like a Tetris kind of like game. Where is it that I fit in? You know, because growing up in the UK, I always knew that, you know, being Chinese was being different. I was only one of two Chinese families in the town that I lived in, and we were both surnamed Chan. And so everyone thought we were related. And we used to joke, we'd be like, yeah, we're just cousins, you know, like distant cousins. And so moving to Hong Kong then, I went shopping with my mum one day. It was a sneaker shop. And I remember the sales assistant asking me questions in Cantonese, and I was doing my best to answer, you know, her questions. And she turns to my mom and she goes, wah, guai mui zaya, like, what a little white girl. And I immediately, you know, at 14, to kind of have that experience where, you know, growing up in the UK, you're never white enough. You're never English enough. And then, you know, you move to Hong Kong and you're living amongst people that look like you and feel like family. And still, I wasn't meeting their quota and expectations. So I really didn't feel like I belonged anywhere truly for a very long time.
Yeah, I feel like that is definitely a common feeling amongst people who have moved from like one country where they were the minority to now they're part of the majority. And it's interesting because it like worked in reverse for you, because a lot of people come from a country where they're the majority and then all of a sudden they're like, there's no one who looks like me. So it's interesting to hear your personal experience on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a quintessential diaspora experience, right? We see a lot in like, you know, Asian American literature, you know, that crisis of there's a lot of, you know, back to the homeland literature where it's like, how do you deal now that you're like amongst your people, but also not, because your culture is different now? And I think that's, you know, for a lot of us, that we either moved or we were born in a new place, not by choice, but because our parents needed to move. And then because of that, now we're like kind of disconnected and feel like it is definitely like a quintessential experience to like experience that reverse culture shock, right?
Yeah. I also feel like, you know, there is this sense of shame that does come around, you know, this move for me at least, because growing up in the UK, I had this idea that I was never going to like really move anywhere else. And I was, you know, British Chinese, which meant that like speaking English only was, I would be fine, you know. And then I kind of moved to Hong Kong. Thanks, mom. Thanks, dad. And then this shame started to envelop around me where I realized, holy crap, I really should have focused more in Chinese school. I really should have learned more Cantonese. And yeah, so that also took a very long time to overcome and learn more about really my roots and my ancestors and their language, and trying to honor that at the same time that I'm trying to recover from this shame around it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, to be fair, like the country that our parents and like grandparents leave behind, that's not really the same country that we, you know, go back to as homecoming. Sometimes the language is completely different. I've heard that like Cantonese is kind of fading away in Hong Kong, and now Mandarin is becoming like more common. And I'm like, oh, that's, you know, that's very different from like 10 years ago. So, yeah, like I really feel you on not paying attention enough in like language school, and then going to the motherland and being like, crap, I communicate like an elementary school student. I don't have the vocabulary. And it's must have been like very frustrating for you because you were a teenager and you already have like all these big emotions and you're going through so much change.
Yeah. Now imagine my predicament with my elementary school vocabulary, trying to pass down language to my kids who are third generation Asian American.
Well, they have their own culture. Yeah, it'll be different. Every generation has their own struggles.
Yeah.
But in your acknowledgments, you mentioned that your grandfather told you stories about the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong. And like, what stories did he tell you? And do you remember what your reaction was to hearing them as like a teenager?
I do. I actually started learning about my grandfather's disdain towards the Japanese occupation much younger than when I was 14. It started when my parents used to take me back to Hong Kong during the Mid-Autumn Festival, or if it was like the tomb sweeping ceremonies. And so we have this village in the New Territories in Hong Kong. My grandfather's the Hakka clan descendant. So we've got these really beautiful like stone courtyard houses and lots of wild dogs running around everywhere. And so I remember like after dinner every night, we would sit in the courtyard and my grandfather would kind of like lean in and he'd be like, Emma, I need to tell you about what happened in the past. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm thinking it's going to be like stories about dragons and fairies and stuff, you know. And he starts talking to me about a war and an occupation of the Hong Kong people. He starts telling me how he was only 6 years old when Japan basically invaded Hong Kong, occupied the territory and the lands. And then he would tell me really passionately about how the Hakka people, a lot of them joined the East River Column resistance during that time. And I think what really stunned me was, you know, that this is something that was happening to my direct like family. I didn't really understand it much. And then, you know, the first time I heard these stories, I was only about 8 years old. And so all I really felt and observed at that time was just this immense pain and hatred in my grandfather's expression. And I couldn't understand it. I couldn't, you know, unravel what it meant at that time, you know. So I just sat quietly and listened to his stories and, you know, and accepted that, yeah, Japanese people were very bad, you know. And then it wasn't until I was older and I started to learn more about history, not in school, because school was always teaching us Western history, like, oh my God. So it was like I had to go out there and find my own history. And then I realized what my grandfather was talking about all these years ago and why he was so passionate when he spoke about it, because some of the things that the Japanese Imperial Army did, it was atrocious. It's, you know, they are war crimes. And yeah, so it was very hard to digest at that age, still very hard to digest at this age.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely go more into like historical aspects of your book, especially with like Japanese. But before that, like, were you always a writer? Because it sounds like your grandfather told you these stories at a very young age and kind of like helped nurture you as like a storyteller. So I'm curious as to like when writing became a part of your life.
Practicing Chinese calligraphy was something that my grandfather did every morning. So he would have breakfast and then he would practice calligraphy and then do like an hour of Tai Chi. So he used to be a Tai Chi master in Chinatown back in London. And during summer holidays, I would stay like the full 6 weeks with my grandparents in London. So that was our routine. It was breakfast and then just sitting there, just like copying words, which he always gave me the easy Chinese words to write, which was like big, small, fire, sky, you know. So while he's sitting there writing full like poetry and everything. So the act of writing started at a very young age, and the love of being in a place with my grandfather in a quiet room, just writing, you know, and there's no other really sounds going around. I don't know. I think that kind of instilled some kind of peace in me, even as a very young kid. Then I would say writing creatively then happened when I was in year 7, because the year before that, my mum picked me up from school one day, and we went to the shopping mall in town, and she took me to the Disney store, and she's like, "You've been good this week, so you can have like one thing." And yeah, just, you know, you're a kid in a Disney store. It's like, wow. And I remember running towards the section where I saw a couple of Mulan things. And I picked up this Mulan diary, and it was plastic, and it had like a little plastic lock and a key. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I just picked it because I saw an Asian person. Like, you know, it was like, oh my gosh, like she looks like me. And, you know, then my mum told me the story of like Hua Mulan, and I was just like obsessed for the longest time. And then the writing came when in year seven, my dad told me that we would be moving to Hong Kong. And I didn't know how to express what I was feeling at the time. And the Mulan diary was there. So I just started writing how I was feeling. And that's the first time I realized that you could actually put feelings into words. And then that just never stopped. So it was constant writing emotional stuff.
Yeah. So when did you start your like creative writing journey? When did you start writing like fiction, like to start short stories? Was it fanfic? Like what was your journey to like becoming a novelist?
Oh, it started in high school. I loved drama and English the most. And we were reading a lot of old white men books. And again, I had to sort of like go to the library and literally find my own kind of books to read. And I came across Amy Tan and Yung Chung and, you know, Lisa C. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? This is brilliant. And so I started writing it started off as poetry. Then it kind of went into writing short pieces of my experiences moving from the UK to Hong Kong. And then that in my early 20s, so after high school, it then formed into a young adult manuscript, which I worked on for a couple years more. And during that time, the stories that my grandfather told me started to kind of come back to me a little bit. And I was like researching, and these characters in When Sleeping Women Wake started to form in my mind and appear and, you know, show me this kind of life that they might have lived. So then I started working on that too. So I was working on like two stories over 10 years. I finished the young adult manuscript first, and I remember submitting that to agents in Australia. And, you know, I got so many rejections, which is so normal, because I think if you want to be a writer, that's just like part of the whole process, is you just have rejections and you get over it. But one rejection came in that really, really shook me for a good 3 months, I reckon. And it was the sentence that this agent wrote said, "I really liked your Y manuscript. I like your narrative voice, but I already have an Asian author on my list for next year."
Oh my God, no.
And I thought, oh my God, did I read that right? Like, are they allowed to say things like that? Like, I know, you know, the industry can be quite racist, and it's still, you know, not that progressed over the years, but I didn't realize that they could actually have the confidence to write something like that, you know?
The audacity.
Just like admitting that, oh, we have a quota and it's filled with one.
Oh my God. Yeah. And that, I mean, all the other rejections, really, I was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. I will go back and work on my book. But this rejection, it was personal, wasn't it? You know? So, yeah, I was upset for a very long time. And during the time that I was upset, I went back and just kept working on When Sleeping Women Wake and just kept writing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Seems like a good book to, like, channel some righteous rage into.
I was going to say, like, When Sleeping Women Wake was such an ambitious ambitious work for a first novel. And I was like, oh, I wonder if she wrote anything else. But you answer that question. You worked on a YA novel and got a racist person to send you feedback. And you're like, okay, let's work on the other manuscript that I'm already working on. So for our listeners who don't know what your debut novel is about, can you give us a short elevator pitch?
Absolutely. I feel like I really know my elevator pitch now. So
that's great.
When Sleeping Women Wake is a historical fiction novel set during Japanese occupied Hong Kong. It spans 1941 to 1945. So the 3 years, 8 months of occupation And it follows the story of three women. We have a mother, Mingju, her daughter Tiang, and their maid Biyu. When Japan invades and takes over, these three women are basically separated. And throughout the entire novel, the main thread, I suppose, of each of their journeys is they survive not for themselves, they survive to find one another again.
Yeah. You know, World War II is a lot of people like writing about that time because it's like, you know, the last global crisis, right? And like, you know, the last time we faced imperialism and fascism on like a global scale. And like an interesting thing about like it being your book being set in Hong Kong is like we've also read books like set in Shanghai during this time, and because these are cities with huge foreign influence, right? Like back then Hong Kong was still a colony of the British Empire, and there's this like false sense of security that a lot of people, especially the more wealthy people in those cities, have, that like we're safe because we have the protection of this global power. We're safe because we have money. We're good. And then they find out real quick that like wealth and proximity to power does not actually save you when you get invaded. So can you talk a little bit about like, you know, choosing to set your story not only in Hong Kong, but also around a family that like has that fall from grace?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good question because, yeah, the book is set during a time where Hong Kong was still very much a British colony. So in a way, it went from one occupation to another, you know. I think what strikes me most about some of the history that I researched is just how many people truly believed that, you know, they were safe from Japan because it was a British colony. But what they didn't come to realize was, you know, Britain was also very busy at that time fighting off Germany on the other side of the world. And I say this a lot, and this is something my grandfather used to say, is Hong Kong is the child that the parent doesn't love the most. It's like,
oh,
Hong Kong is like the kid that always just gets left behind because China gave us away, and then when the British couldn't help, they basically was like, okay, Japan, we give up, like, here, take Hong Kong. And so Hong Kong just felt like this like tennis ball, like going from like one court to the other, you know, amongst these two players. And I think it's a really sad thing to think about. And I think, you know, this kind of history again, and colonization and occupation, is what then really ruins a city and a country's identity and self of like worth. Because if you're looking at Hong Kong on a political scale now, it's like, what is our identity? I think we are still really trying to figure that out. But while we're trying to figure that out, there's still like this huge power above us that's kind of like creeping back in. And so, sense of loss, I think, at the moment. But historically, yeah, I think rich families particularly really felt they had some kind of connection to the British Empire, and they thought they were safe.
Like, it's so sad to hear, because they were banned from so many like establishments, and it's like, hey, like, you're a wealthy Chinese like aristocrat, and you still can't like dine at this hotel that all of the rich white people, the British, are dining at. Like, why do you want to be close to that? So, yeah, it's mind games.
It's weird. There's this really rich guy back in the 40s, and his name's like Sir Robert Ho Tong, and he's like was very famous in Hong Kong, and he was like one of the first like wealthy Chinese merchant families to actually afford to buy land and property on the Peak, which is like one of the like most expensive real estate places in Hong Kong. But then, you know, because of this thing that was passed, Chinese people weren't allowed to live on the Peak. So he had this huge mansion that he had to rent out to a British person. And he and his family went and lived in a small place in like Kowloon or something. And so when you read that stuff and you read that history, it's maddening because, you know, how could they treat us like that? It's like, that was our home. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much like history on like the prejudice against the Chinese, and also like the Chinese against their own as well. You mentioned in your author's note the extensive research you did into the history, and also looking into the resistance group in Hong Kong during the Japanese occupation. I'm just curious to hear like what your research process was in preparing for this novel. Obviously, you had like information from like your grandparents who told you stories from when you were young. But like, did you have to go deep into the archives somewhere to get some of the hidden history?
Yes and no. History. I just love history. I could dive into archives for hours. I spent half a day last week researching trains, and I don't even know if I'm going to use it in my next book, but it's just part of the process, right? I have to say, obviously, I took a lot of creative liberty with writing these three female characters. And the reason why is because when I was researching this specific time in history in Hong Kong, there were just buckets load of historical facts, papers, photographs, diaries that were written by the British, Canadian, Australian, American civilians in Hong Kong that were interned in these camps that the Japanese were running at the time. So that historically, if you want to research World War II in Hong Kong, the first thing you get is all the white stories and the white experiences. So then when you are trying to find the Chinese voice, it is really damn hard. So that was the biggest challenge. And so for me, I remembered how my grandfather was talking to me about being proud of being Hakka, how the Hakka was involved in a resistance movement. And so I took that and I went into, you know, like Google Scholar. I went to like my university library and I just like typed those words in. And I did. I managed to find a lot of, you know, secondhand written accounts of what had happened with the East River Column Resistance. And then I learned from that how many women and children were involved, you know, with this movement too, and how they were all made up of Hakka people and Hong Kong locals of the time. And then one day I was just looking up something online, and I think this was in 2015, and the South China Morning Post had actually posted an article and a YouTube video where this journalist interviews a now elderly woman who gives her firsthand account of her joining the resistance when she was just a kid with her sister and her mum. And I just, yeah, I burst out crying because for years I was trying to find this woman's voice during that time. And it was there, and she was talking about her experiences. But yeah, it was hard. Research was hard.
Yeah, I feel like it's such a common like refrain we hear from a lot of like, you know, families who, you know, all our families, our grandparents experienced World War II like firsthand, right? They were alive during that time. I'm Chinese, Ria was Korean, like we were in it, right, with the Japanese Empire. And so like the most common refrain is people don't want to talk about it, right? Because they had to experience famine, they had to experience, you know, uncertainty, unstabilization. They were all refugees at some point, right? And we're getting to a point where people are starting to like realize their stories are important and like seeking it out. But it also feels like my grandparents have passed away now, so I can't ask them about their experiences. But, you know, my mom has like audio logs of my grandfather talking about his time in the Chinese army. You know, he was in the Air Force fighting the Japanese. And so those stories aren't going to be we won't have even have firsthand accounts for much longer, right?
I mean, it's our generation's like duty, I think. And I think that's why we're seeing such a growth in like historical fiction and memoirs by Asian American and Asian diaspora authors, because they're like, we need to get this story recorded before it's gone forever, because we're at that time frame now. So yeah, it's like totally understandable with like research being so hard because the material just wasn't there.
You also want to like, I think for us, you know, as descendants of people that have gone through such atrocities, we want to in a way honor and record the history before it's, like you said, erased or even worse, rewritten for us, you know. And a lot of historical fiction, you know, when I was even reading certain books, are written by white authors about Asia, and it's like through a completely different lens. And that was another thing that really made me even more in a rush to kind of like want to get the story out, because I do not want my family's history to be rewritten by someone that has no connection and no like almost right to the claim of writing that story.
Yeah. I was just thinking about how like for the longest time as a kid, my only like representation of like World War II stories in Asia was like Empire of the Sun, starring Christian Bale, about like, you know, the British.
Oh, no. Like, you know. Oh, no, that's so sad.
The British family guy that got, you know, put in a Japanese prison camp in Shanghai, right?
Yeah, there was definitely a market for a while of like historical fiction novels set in Shanghai. And the main character is like a white lady who's like married to like a like an officer, and they're trying to like figure like they're like, oh, I'm like a fish out of water.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, fish out of water, like we're fishes out of water too, like diasporans here. We had to leave our homeland because of war, because of you guys. So yeah, like I have like a lot of thoughts about that, but we are here to talk about your book. So
I could talk about this for hours with you.
Yeah.
No. So what compelled you to write about the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong from the perspective of three women? You could have easily written from one POV. You could have written in just like a more like historical lens, because if I felt like your book, which I really enjoyed, it really gets into like the emotions of the three women, and I think that's why I love this so much, because you can get bogged down by historical accuracy quite a lot in a lot of like historical fiction novels. So what made you want to write from the perspective of these three women?
Well, I think the basic answer would be I could never put myself in the shoes of a man, because I don't want to. Sorry, Marvin. And I think it comes back down to when my grandfather used to tell me these stories, as an 8-year-old, what I was observing was the silences of my grandmother. She'd sit there peeling, you know, oranges, cracking nuts open, and just feeding everyone like all Asian grandmas do, you know, bless them. But I wanted to know, what was her story? Why is she not talking about it? And Marvin mentioned before, you know, a lot of people didn't want to talk about what had happened to their families. And it was very important for me to explore what women's silences meant. And I could have easily gone, like you said, Vera, to write a book that doesn't really focus that much on three different women. But I was like, no, I think women in history, we have been silenced enough. I am ready to write a story that really focuses on the strength of women, especially during this time. I also, as much as I really love even reading Lisa See's books, I do feel that sometimes her female characters, Chinese characters, are not the kind of strong female characters that I as a reader want, you know. I really want a strong Chinese woman that from the start to the middle to the finish is just a badass, like, because I feel as though we are, when I see my grandmother, when I know that she was married to my grandfather in an arranged marriage at like 14 or 15. Then she had three kids. Then she waited for my grandfather when he went to the UK to work on merchant navy ships. And she didn't hear from him for like years. And she had to like live in this village and fend for herself. And all the way up until now, like nothing about her story has been weak. Every single thing she has done has been survival, strength, and about, you know, raising her family. So it was very important for me to have more than one perspective, especially because women could do so many different things. So I wanted one character to go off and show off her language skills. And then I wanted someone to be more of a physical fighter. And then I wanted, you know, BU to show that kind of sense of empathy and how resistance doesn't always have to be action. It can come in very quiet forms of action as well. Yeah.
Yeah, your character is definitely not like the passive Chinese women of like classic like Asian American literature, Asian diaspora literature. And something that I really like keyed in on was like, you know, your story against centers on three women and the resistance to the Japanese occupation. But before the Japanese were even there, they were living their whole lives under like patriarchal oppression, right? Like the classic Chinese flavor of like oppression. And, you know, honestly, the biggest antagonist in like the first act of your book was literally Chinese patriarchy, right? Wifely duties, male child preference, etc. Can you talk about how you explored like the themes of like female like resilience and resistance to patriarchy through your novel as well?
I think it was very important for me to talk a bit, or at least explain a little bit about the history there, like to readers, because it really wasn't that long ago when we think about it. It's like just our, even our mother's generation was still under the influence of some of these structures that were put in place by the patriarchy, right? And so I think it was very important for me to put that in the book, explore that just a little bit. And I wanted, I guess it was in a way for me to then develop certain characters' arc. That they had something to push back against, right, before the Japanese kind of come. And so for Mingju, the wife, she obviously is an arranged marriage, but and her husband is just this prick that just full on very traditional values. But then he kind of goes from like old Chinese values moving into Hong Kong, then taking over like this British persona, right? So that also would be very conflicting and confusing for a character like Mingju. But what I really liked about her as a character, and this is something I feel like she kind of showed me the way, is she can still be the wife of this person, but she doesn't have to always live by his rules. And so even if she does have to follow certain social things, she tries extremely hard to make sure that that ends with her and it's not carried forward into the next generation. And she works very hard to make sure that her daughter understands that her daughter has more rights, more freedom, and that she should be pursuing those things.
So. Yeah, I absolutely love the relationship between Mingju and her daughter. Just like how much love there is and of just like protection too, of like you, like even though your father prefers a male child, like you are like the gem. You're the apple of my eye. And like most of your characters are multilingual, especially like Mingju, and their language abilities put them in a place of both privilege and danger. Can you talk about how languages played a role in the political landscape of your book, and also just the relationship between mother and daughter and how like education was viewed?
That was very intentional for me to make sure that my characters were educated, privileged, and multilingual. And I know that some readers might take issue with that because some, and even the US publisher, they were kind of like, oh, like, you know, I sometimes feel like in this industry, they prefer to read our stories when it's more focused on trauma and us being poor and broke and uneducated and we're struggling and we're suffering. And I'm a little bit over that. Because historically,
yeah, me too.
You know, historically speaking, Korea, China, Singapore, Hong Kong, like there were extremely educated Asians back then, you know, they were well-schooled, they could speak several languages. And so I think it was very intentional for me because I was like, whoever's going to read this book needs to know that, you know, the fact is back then in the 40s, there were people that looked like this, that could speak English properly, that could speak French, that could speak other languages and were allowed to go to school. And so I was really trying not to fall into that trope that publishing always wants us people of color to fall into, which is only talk about your trauma, only talk about you being poor, you know? So I was very intentional on my behalf. And I also wanted them to come from privilege to then really contrast and show their downfall and how they kind of get through that, but with compassion and humanity. So these women don't ever take their privilege for granted. They take it and they try to use it for good.
It must have been challenging also to describe the violence that the Japanese inflicted on the locals during this period. I mean, like we mentioned, like the war crimes, they were atrocious. And you know, your characters also like witness horrific things. How did you balance the tight, like the wire between keeping historical accuracy and just being sensitive to the victims' lived in experience? Because I don't think you went too graphic without, you know, traumatizing your readers.
I love that question because, you know, as a reader, a lot of the historical fiction novels I read, specifically that center around the Japanese occupation where women are involved. Some books are too graphic for me for fiction, and it's something that I actually think diminishes the woman's identity and name, and it puts the focus on the act of what is happening to her rather than who she was. So I think for me it was hard because you have to read a lot of historical details of what occurred. And so many days after research, I was not in a very good headspace, I have to admit. You know, you kind of, after reading certain things, you sit there and you stare at a wall and you're just thinking, what the hell did I just read? Like, how can someone do that to another human being? You know, it's almost hard to believe. But I think it's very important to weave in the atrocities that were committed. I tried really hard not to gloss over it, but I was really, really sure not to write in every single little detail of what happens to certain people, because I mean, I feel like readers are intelligent enough to know from like one line or two exactly what they need to picture. And I think when writers do explicitly write a scene of trauma or an atrocity, I think that actually is a bad writer because, I just think you're diminishing that person's identity by doing that.
Yeah, a lot of the times, like, if you are going really graphic with just the trauma, like, it's almost like just for a shock factor. Like, it's not really for narrative purposes. It's just like, oh, okay, like, this is a way to make my writing, like, more impactful, but in, like, a very negative way where it's, like, not enjoyable at all.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, like, if we were to list all the war crimes and atrocities that Japan committed, I mean, it's thicker than the Bible, you know? But I don't know why every historical fiction book always wants to center on the sexual assault side of things. And while that did happen, I knew I had to obviously place that into the book somewhere, but I did not want to go too far into it because there were like so many other things that were being committed at the time that I could also explore and talk about.
That being said, your book does have a couple really, I feel like, really good action scenes that do, you know, have like, I would say, tasteful amounts of, you know, violence and viscera. So I thought you kind of straddled that line pretty well, too. All right, you know, you have two prominent characters in your novel that are actually Japanese sympathizers, like sympathizers in the Japanese Imperial Army. Were there any real life examples that inspired these characters? And, you know, why was it important for you to include their voices as well?
Oh, my gosh. So that's the other thing, you know, reading a lot of historical books, I wanted to explore two sides of occupation. And one of the things that going into the book, because it took me 10 years to write, I was very much on the side of all Japanese people at that time were just assholes and like bad, bad people. Okay. So that was kind of where the book was headed for. But then I landed a job in retail like years ago, and I was working in Muji in Australia, and great store. And one of my colleagues is mixed race. So she's like a quarter Japanese, something Chinese. And she was telling me how her grandparents met during the war and how her grandfather was actively helping certain resistance movements in China. And that's how he fell in love with her grandmother. And after the war, he didn't hand himself over. They actually escaped and ran away. And I'm pretty sure they ended up in the US before then migrating again to Australia. And when I heard that story, I was so intrigued because I almost forgot that in the midst of chaos and war, some people really can fall in love. Some people really can look out for one another. And I think the mindset that I had where like every single person was bad, it really changed my view. Almost like I kind of grew up a little bit, you know, and realized that there's more to it than just claiming an entire race of people is bad. And I would think it would be poor form of me as a writer and a person of color to continue that narrative.
Yeah, I think people do forget that like Japanese like nationals were brainwashed by the empire. They really thought that they were quote unquote saving East Asia from the powers of like the Western influence. And it's like, yeah, but also we don't want to be under your occupation either.
Like, yeah. It's you know, it's comforting to know that there are people who in the face of like atrocities can say, hey, are we the baddies?
Yeah.
Maybe,
like this kind of reminds me of his last name was Sugihara, and he was a Japanese diplomat who during the Second World War, he like wrote transit visas for Jews who were escaping from Germany. And they and like he was risking his career and the lives of his family. But, you know, he was just like, I'm like, this is wrong. I'm going to do my part to not be a part of war crimes. And it's like, OK, there are people in the occupation, in the oppressive powers that have conscience and won't cross certain lines. So I was really happy that you did include characters like that in your book.
Yeah.
So you said it took like 10 years to write this book, and I'm sure it's like a relief to have it be out there in the world. Is there another work that you're, you know, currently working on, or are you like just having a moment to just rest and reset before diving in to another work?
I'm already halfway through book two. It's only because wow. I got a 2-book deal in the UK and Australia. And so there's a deadline involved this time, which is really, really stressful. And the original, I had started writing another book towards the end of When Sleeping Women Wake. And I had almost finished it. And then my agent was like, let's not go with that because there are so many stories like that coming out right now. And I fully agree with her. And so I went back into, okay, When Sleeping Women Wake was very much to honor the silences of women. Now let's turn to my grandfather. And he was a Chinese merchant. He was in the Merchant Navy in the UK in the 70s. And I started exploring, you know, what life was like for Chinese people in the UK at that time. Bad. But then that then led me to World War II again, because not that long ago, the British Home Office declassified some documents. And these documents are being evaluated by historians at the moment still. And what happened was after World War II, the UK basically had no need for all the Chinese and Indians and Africans that they had basically shipped over to the UK to help work in the Merchant Navy. They basically illegally deported all these people of colour away from the UK. But what happened was a lot of Chinese men at this time already had married white English women and started families. So these women and their kids woke up one morning and it was like, oh, dad's gone. Where is dad? And they, yeah, just these Chinese men were illegally deported. And that's now taken me to a whole nother story. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, very relatable to, unfortunately relatable to what's happening in our immigration system on this side of the world.
Oh, yeah, scary.
So, yeah.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Boba. And yeah, hope to, looking forward to what comes next for me.
Thank you so much, Marvin. Thanks, Vera.
And that was Emma Pei-Yin. Her debut novel, When Sleeping Women Wake, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation and want to check out Emma's book, head on over to booksandboba.com, check out our bookshop link. As always, all purchases on our online bookstore support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So we definitely appreciate everyone who has purchased a book on there so far. All right. Before we call it an episode, Rira, can you remind us what we are reading for book club for September 2025?
Yeah, so we are reading A Witch's Guide to Magical Innkeeping by Sangu Mandana. And it is a whimsical, cozy novel about a witch who has a second chance to get her magical powers and her life back on track. And this is set in the same universe as the Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches.
Yeah, ready for all the cozy vibes. And as always, if you are a Patreon supporter, you can read along with us on our Discord server, where we are discussing the book as we go. And for those of you not on our Patreon, you can also let us know your thoughts about the book on our Goodreads forums as well. But yeah, with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Emma Payen for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Leah Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Great news! The Korean Drama Podcast is back for our sixth season.
The Korean Drama Podcast is the podcast about watching Korean dramas by people who don't watch Korean dramas. Hosted by Candace, Jane, and me, Kim.
Wait, if it's our sixth season, can we still say we're people who don't watch Korean dramas?
I'm sure it's fine. Let's just call it character development, which we love in K-dramas.
For our new season, we're recapping the hit 2025 romantic fantasy series Heavenly Ever After, about an elderly couple who reunite in the afterlife, only he's now in his 30s while she's chosen to appear in her 80s.
Awkward.
So join us each week as we discuss the highs and lows of the afterlife in Heavenly Ever After, episode by episode.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.